From the corner of Asher and University at KUAR Public Radio Studios, this is the Week in Review podcast.
Donald Trump prepares for the White House and Asa Hutchinson prepares for Donald Trump.
The answers are in on pollution along the Buffalo National River, but experts are still wading through the swine muck.
The legislative session is a month away, but bills are already trickling down.
71,000 light bulbs in a pigskin, the weekend in leisure. That's all coming up from the Week in Review from KUAR Public Radio. I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
Michael Hiblin's with us too. For our first segment, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump and Asa Hutchinson. I sat down with our news director, Michael Hiblin, earlier in the week. Enjoy. We've heard a lot the past couple weeks about Donald Trump's transition team. We've had a number of Arkansans, like Mike Huckabee and Leslie Rutledge and Tom Cotton, all go to the Trump Tower up in New York City to go talk to Donald Trump. Michael, you caught up with Governor Asa Hutchinson. He had a phone call with Donald Trump this week, the first time they've spoken since the election.
Yeah, and he shared details of that while speaking to the Arkansas Farm Bureau. And we learned that really what he's looking more to get from President-elect Trump.
I was going to say, one of the big issues that particularly has an impact in Arkansas is the issue of health care and what Donald Trump might do with health care. Of course, he wants to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The big question is what it'll be replaced with. Do we have any indication of what the governor said?
Well, the governor is expecting that the Affordable Care Act will be repealed, and he's wanting the Trump administration to allow states to get Medicaid block grants. In my interview with him, I caught up with him Wednesday evening. He said that he wants states to have more flexibility and control. But for now,
we've got to get our waivers approved through this administration, which they're on their way out the door, but we're still waiting on those waivers to be approved. And then there's going to be a time of transition. I did speak to President-elect Trump about this, and I'm going to be meeting with the transition team next week on the health care issues, just really helping to shape it. And, as long as we have a good time in transition, as long as they give the states more flexibility and control and a greater ability to put in work requirements, we'll be fine. We just need that flexibility here in Arkansas.
And since that interview, I asked J.R. Davis, the governor's spokesman, when and where that would be happening, his meeting with the transition team. He said he didn't have any information yet, but I imagine that will probably be in New York at the Trump Tower.
I heard some excerpt from the Farm Bureau speech I think we ran during Morning Edition where the governor said he was going to serve the Trump administration in Arkansas, though. He doesn't have an interest in leaving the governor's office to join his cabinet or anything like that. But the healthcare thing, the big argument all along has been, instead of being fixed to the guidelines of Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, which is based on how much income you make. If you make 140% below poverty, then you get Medicaid expansion insurance. The governor has wanted this thing called block grants, which he mentioned in his quote, which is basically the federal government gives each state a big chunk of money, and then they can kind of divvy it out how they want. One big difference, though, is all the plans in Congress from Republicans, like Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. They would give the block grants, but that block grant money would not continue the additional money for Medicaid expansion, which is like the 300,000 or so people in Arkansas. But Governor Hutchinson, all the way back in last April, we asked him, and he said he wants that block grant to have that money to keep those people covered in Arkansas. So we'll see how that shapes out. It's kind of a difference.
Yeah, it really is. There's a lot to be determined and what this means for all the people in Arkansas who have been on what has been the private option, Governor Beebe's term for it, and what Governor Hutchinson is transitioning into Arkansas works. Yeah, exactly. Whether or not they will be able to keep that money and whether or not any of this program will continue really depends on what happens.
Kind of the difference between the governors governing in the states and what's going on in Washington. But the other part, the main focus, I guess, of the governor's speech to the Farm Bureau that you watched, Michael, was about general trade and issues like Cuba.
Yeah, and in particular with Cuba, he says this really is an opportunity. Of course, Arkansas has been working to build up a relationship with Cuba, views the 11 million residents there who live on the island as perfect market for Arkansas rice. The governor has also taken part in a trade mission to China, working to not only expand markets there for agricultural products, but also to try and get firms from China to come to Arkansas. So here is a segment of him. This was speaking to the Arkansas Farm Bureau's annual conference in Hot Springs.
We've had an interesting twist this last week or so when we've had the death of Fidel Castro. And I have remarked that this gives us an opening not just to re-engage in more trade opportunities with Cuba, but also an opening to reinvigorate and to bring alive again freedom to the people of Cuba. And it's really an interesting changing dynamics because there's a lot of momentum right now going toward expansion of trade with Cuba and a different policy. But with the death of Fidel Castro, it's like the expectation level went up. And not only from our side in terms of increased trade opportunities, but also there is greater pressure now, and rightfully so, for the Cuban regime to change and to give more freedom and to release some of the dissidents they've been holding in their jails. And so the pressure is on Cuba, really, to enhance and to show good faith that they're going to have a change in direction. And when that happens, you're going to see then, I believe, increased opportunity, increased willingness of Congress to reengage with Cuba in terms of trade, and that will be good for Arkansas agriculture. I'll continue to be a voice for that. I also, though, went to China. And the first trip to China, we brought back Sun Paper for a $1 billion investment in South Arkansas in the timber industry. That is a part of our agricultural community. It is important to our economy in South Arkansas, and I've continued to meet with them. They're continuing to invest and prepare for that investment. This last trip to China, we were able to sign an agreement with Tianyin Garment Company. It is the first garment company that did not leave the United States and go to China, but they are leaving China and coming to the United States. And it's not your father's garment company. This company is highly mechanized and will pay over $14 an hour in their facility, in their workplace, will provide over 400 jobs for Arkansans. But I did something different this last trip as well. I said, it's not just about bringing jobs back here. Let us work and use this opportunity as governor to put pressure on the China government to open up their markets to us. And so I asked for the meeting, and I had a meeting with the Vice Minister of Agriculture in China. I thank them for opening up the China market to our beef products here in the United States. That is a great opening for us. But I said, you also need to open your market to our poultry and to our rice. And let me tell you, in China, with the market that they have, they produce, but they do not produce enough for their own people. And they are importing rice and agricultural products and food products, and nothing beats what we have in the United States, and that market needs to be open to us. So the global market is important. And I want to tell you that less than 24 hours ago, I had a conversation with President-elect Donald Trump. And I congratulated him on his win. And I wanted to make clear to him that I want to support this administration outside of Washington. I want to support this administration as governor of Arkansas. And I want to shape it in the right direction for Arkansas agriculture and the Arkansas economy. And I stress to President-elect Trump the importance of the global market to Arkansas's economy. And that is true in agriculture, but it is also true in terms of our exports, in terms of the opportunity for direct investment from China here in this state. So it was a good conversation. I'll tell you, he is working hard. He called me back about 10:30 Eastern Standard Time. It was the allotted time, I think, that he could call before he started doing his tweets. I say that a little bit jokingly, but Donald Trump is going to redefine the presidency. Stay tuned. And I'm delighted with the cabinet that he's putting in place. I'm delighted with the outreach that he has. Very interested, and it's going to be a responsibility for us to educate him, a New Yorker, on agricultural policy. Think about how important that is. And so, but there is that opportunity because I believe that what's ahead is an administration that is not going to treat Mid-America as flyover region.
So there we have a long segment from the governor there, but I guess really hoping to have an influence on the incoming administration.
It sounds like he might need to have that influence if he wants to get what he wants based on some of Trump's campaign promises. You know, Donald Trump has kind of signaled against opening up ties with Cuba to some degree, mm-hmm. and he's definitely wary of kind of free trade and wants more tariffs and stuff like that. So, but we'll see. There's all sorts of different things, different ways it could shake out. I guess I'll just mention on the congressional front, pretty much all of Arkansas's congressmen, with the exception of Tom Cotton, also are pretty pro opening up Cuba trade. All right, Chris, it's just you and me again, live, so to speak, in the studio. That's a great segment with Michael, though. Let's move on to kind of the big environmental story of the week, although there were really two, but let's do the first one. The Buffalo National River, there's been this argument since Mike Beebe days, since they installed the CNH, the first CAFO, concentrated animal feeding operation in the state, and it's along the nation's first river, the Buffalo National River. There's always the debate about, well, is it really going to pollute the river? What did we find out?
Well, not much yet. There was a study that was commissioned by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality. They had hired an outside consultant, a Little Rock-based company called Harbor Environmental and Safety, to do a drilling study where they drilled like 120 feet below the grounds of CNH Hog Farms, as you said, a very large swine feeding operation near Big Creek, which is a tributary of the Buffalo National River. 6,000 pigs and plus are raised there. There are a couple of waste storage ponds. That environmental advocates have argued the waste from that, the manure and stuff, may be leaking into the ground and mm-hmm. Eventually, you know, getting into the watershed and down the Buffalo and so forth. So, yeah, as you said, it's been a controversy since the Mike Beebe days. I think CNH went online or started operating in 2013, early 2013.
And there's now a moratorium in place for further type
operations. Yeah, there's a five-year moratorium in place for these large CAFOs. Back in September, this drilling study took place, where the actual drilling at the site took place. And we just got the results this week. ADEQ held a presentation.
Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality.
Yes, held a presentation on Thursday, the same day they received the results from Harbor Environmental. And, you know, it's from a layperson's perspective, and even some of the, I guess, geologists and other officials, environmental officials and activists who are present at the presentation, didn't really know exactly what to make of it, because there's Tom Huter, a geologist with Harbor Environmental, listed off findings of sampling. He compared some of the mineral concentrations to a USGS study that had been done in Newton County in 2004. But basically, it was a presentation where a bunch of facts were listed off, but not a lot of context was applied to them in the presentation. And additionally, ADEQ did not allow anyone to ask questions of the presenter, the consultant. Well, actually, during the presentation, a couple of people, raised their hand and kind of interjected, a spokeswoman for the ADEQ had to get up and, you know, tell everyone, you know, you shouldn't ask questions. And she directed them to a website and a email address, drillingstudyquestions@adeq.state.r.us for anyone who has questions about the study. Anyways, I'm not going to really play anything from that presentation because, like I said, it's hard to really understand what he's saying. I mean, you can find the study.
You have to be an expert to interpret the data.
Right, exactly. You can find it on our website, though. I have it posted as a link.
Well, do you expect some of these different groups, whether it be ADQ or environmental advocates that are have been like the Buffalo River Watershed Alliance or something like that, do you expect them to have an interpretation provided in the next coming week?
Yeah. Well, I don't know about the coming week. Yeah. I did talk to Gordon Watkins. He's the head of this Buffalo River Watershed Alliance. And I asked him, you know, what he thought about the findings as he heard them.
I guess my gut reaction is relief that there's not an excessive amount of leakage. But until we look into this report further, we're not really going to know. And I think there's a lot of data there that will have to be looked at. There was very little interpretation provided today. We have experts that we'll be depending on to look at this report in detail and see if there's evidence of leakage or not. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that this is one single hole that was drilled.
And he also mentioned that waste from the farm is currently being spread on agricultural lands around Big Creek, and that's kind of a bigger issue for him. I asked him how he thought about how the presentation was handled.
Well, I thought it was a dog and pony show. We were led to believe that there would be a question and answer period, and it's a little disturbing that they wouldn't allow us to ask any questions of the Harbor in particular, and we have no idea who will be answering questions online.
And later on, Becky Keough, who's the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, took me and the other reporter from the Democrat Gazette into a conference room where we were able to ask her questions. Here she is talking about, you know, their initial reaction.
I'd like to take the time to fully review that report and have my trained geologists and engineers review the report and give me recommendations about what they believe is occurring at the site and provide me the information so then I can go ahead and follow up with any report or recommendations to the governor and to the public on what would be the next appropriate steps.
ADQ emphasized that the presentation and the release of the report to the public was done on the same day that the department itself received it, so they didn't really have, you know, any interpretation to offer. I asked her about the prohibition of that question and answer time.
So we felt like answering questions now or putting the consultant in that role to be able to make definitive determinations was not the purpose of today's presentation. So we do want to get back to that point, but I think today it was more about learning for the first time what the data is saying.
Seems kind of strange to me. You'd think the person to ask to interpret the data would be the person who collected it. Because now they'll be getting answers through ADEQ, which did do the report.
That's what, you know, a lot of people were kind of curious about. I mean, Tom Huter, the geologist who made the presentation, it seemed to me just a list of facts that he just went through. He compared calcium concentrations to what had been, you know, known in the in previous or some other phosphorus, for instance, and other things like that. There was mention that during the drilling of that site, when they had to fill up the hole that they dug, they had to actually use extra cement or more cement than they had calculated, which Gordon Watkins pointed out when I talked to him, seemed to indicate that, and also Tom Huter's presentation, he mentioned that at the 25-foot mark, it was where, I guess, there was like a cavity or something in the ground. And Gordon Watkins had mentioned, well, there's this other Big Creek Research and Extension team, which is a group of scientists from the University of Arkansas that are looking at this. They had also, in a previous test, it's called a electrical resistivity test.
Of course.
An ERT. Yeah, which is kind of like looking at underground. And they had found an area around limestone bedrock, which seemed to indicate that there was like a void or some
porous.
Kind of... Yeah, porous that could be related to possibly waste going through that area. And so Gordon Watkins said the geologist, the consultant, seemed to sort of gloss over that fact that they had to fill extra cement or that it suggested there was a void in that area. So I don't know. I think a lot of people will be coming over the report.
Did ADQ ever indicate if they wanted the consultant to come back and answer questions at a later date for the public? Or,
well, yeah, I asked Becky Keough, like, if the consultant would be available to answer questions directly at any point, you know, from the public. And basically she said that they were going to take in, the department was going to take in all the questions and present them to the consultant and then be kind of the intermediary, which is kind of an odd position to be in, I guess, or you know, for consultants like that. I mean, you know, given that it's supposedly an independent consultant, you would think that they'd be able to answer the questions directly, but possibly, I don't know.
Well, on the other hand, it's like the healthcare, I'm thinking of the John Stevens Group, which has been in front of the healthcare task force for like 2 years now. They are there to answer questions. They give all the data, they give the context, and they answer the same question oftentimes meeting after meeting for months. But, you know, members of the public aren't asking them questions. It's the legislators.
That's a good question. I mean, I don't know. They were, when I asked them about it, their answer didn't seem very clear to me as far as like what the course would be in that for the consultant in relations to the public.
All right. That's the state of the Buffalo National River. We'll continue to wait on those test results.
Yeah.
And the UA studied several years long, so they're going
to it's a 5-year thing, and they give quarterly reports to the governor in ADEQ. The governor also, Asa Hutchinson, also recently created a quote-unquote beautiful Buffalo River Action Committee made up of like stakeholders and other, you know, farmers and environmental groups and stuff. They're going to have a meeting, I think, just in the second week of December, their first meeting. And they're supposed to, I was at the announcement earlier this year, and the governor said he was creating this task force to, they're supposed to come up with some sort of non-regulatory management plan for the watershed to kind of deal with issues like this, but not one that's binding, one that's like voluntary for
landowners in the area. Sure. Okay. Well, thanks, Chris. We'll continue to follow that, and maybe we'll check in next week and we'll see if any of these groups have some further analysis of the test results after they've concluded with their own experts. So that's from one part of the state government, the ADEQ, one department. Let's move to the legislative branch, away from the executive. It's still about we've got a month out before the start of the legislative session in January, the regular legislative session. But there's still some action going on in the state capitol. Tons of committees going on, budgeting processes. But today we'll just spend a little bit of time looking at some of the bills that are being filed in advance of the 2017 session. Still tons of time to file bills. These things could look totally different. It's hard to gauge how serious these are or if it's just something these guys are doing during the weekend and submitted it this week. Let's look at one bill first. Campus carry. There's a bill from State Representative Charlie Collins, a Republican from Fayetteville. Of course, Fayetteville, home of the University of Arkansas. He has a bill, or he hasn't filed it yet, but he plans to, that would force college campuses to allow staff and faculty with concealed carry permits to be armed on campus. The current state law, also passed by Charlie Collins in 2013, makes it legal to do that, but each college, through the Board of Trustees, can vote to opt out. And every single college since 2013 has voted to opt out, because none of them want concealed carry on campus. But Charlie Collins, of course, emboldened by even more Republican gains in the state legislature, thinks, aha, this is the year. It's finally going to happen. They're going to have concealed carry on campus. Last year, he tried to do it, but it was split 10 to 10 in the House Education Committee. There were 10 Democrats in that committee last year, so they could block it. This year, there are 3, so it's going to pass pretty much. Okay, so let's take a look at Charlie Collins here. This is the reason why he thinks it's good to have people be armed on college campuses.
One of the things that I believe we can do with my law is to deter some of these cases from happening. After Columbine, the Secret Service and the Department of Education did an intense study on mass shooters and how they operate. And these folks tend to plan out their crimes. One of the things they look at is what, who, how could somebody interrupt them? How could somebody stop them? How could somebody disturb their plan before they're able to carry it out? And the goal of this profile of the mass shooter is somebody who's trying to get attention for himself because he's got some manifesto or some beef that he wants to get out in the public. So by having and allowing concealed carry holders who work on college campuses to carry if they choose to do it, I believe we'll be able to deter some of these killers from choosing Arkansas campuses.
So that's Collins' reason why he didn't go with the argument of it's the Second Amendment right to carry weapons wherever, you know, with no restrictions. It was all about safety for him and based on evidence that he saw based on previous mass shootings. To the argument that every single college has voted for 2 years to not allow this law, saying they don't want it, Charlie Collins thinks that the Board of Trustees aren't as representative of the people as, say, he is.
But the reality is the public institutions in Arkansas are the people's university. What we're talking about with my law is something that will help protect our loved ones away from home, obviously the students, but also, you know, our teachers and other people that work on these campuses. These are public institutions, and so those decisions, in my view, belong with the legislature if we get the votes.
So he does believe that private colleges should be able to say no, but fundamentally it's about he thinks Arkansans have the right to concealed carry. An argument from everyone opposed to it has been that more guns on campus will lead to more accidental shootings, perhaps more intentional shootings just because you have access to a gun, or perhaps confusing police if they see multiple armed people and they show up on the scene.
Obviously, nobody can guarantee that there's never going to be an accident of some sort. But what I would submit is that CCL holders carry in all kinds of places in our everyday lives, from malls to restaurants. And what we're not seeing are significant problems with our concealed carry holders in other locations.
So across town, we've got Democratic State Representative Greg Letting. Both these guys are like really well-established state legislators. They have a lot of experience, a lot of respect probably on both sides of the aisle. Greg Letting also representing parts of the UA campus. He totally disagrees with that logic. He thinks more guns on campus will be more problems.
It won't do anything to make campus safer. In fact, there are studies that show these kinds of policies make campuses less safe. Today's shooting at Ohio State
turned out to be stabbing.
The university responded with a plan immediately. Law enforcement responded with a plan immediately. The last thing that law enforcement needed to worry about when they showed up on campus was some adjunct art history professor running around with a gun trying to pretend to be John McClane or something.
Not a slight on art history professors, though.
No, not a slight on art history professors. But that's not what they're trained to do. And that should not be their role. And quite frankly, I've heard from a lot of professors who worry that this policy would simply make them the first target. If, you know, God forbid, a gunman does barge into a classroom, if you think the only person with a gun in the room is going to be the teacher, why not remove that threat first?
So Collins made the argument also that the legislature is better than deciding the trustees. Greg Letting totally disagrees.
Government needs to be as close to the scene of the action as possible. We don't need people in Little Rock telling the campus in Southern Arkansas what it should or shouldn't do. Campuses need to decide what's best for them. And right now, every board of trustees across the state has each year voted to opt out of this law. That's eventually going to change as the composition of these boards change. So I'm sure that eventually some campus is going to decide to participate. But for now, I think this compromise is the best option. Allow the individual campuses to decide what's best for them.
And that compromise was crafted back in 2013 because Democrats used to have some power, and Collins went along with it at the time. But this time, since Democrats don't really have any power to stop this, to have a compromise bill, Charlie Collins is very confident that it will pass. He doesn't want to put the cart before the horse and that kind of stuff. But Greg Letting, he has a little bit of hope. What chance do you and your ilk have to stop this?
The legislators who oppose this don't have much of a chance. For the people who oppose this legislation, it's really in their hands at this point. They're going to have to call and write all legislators and let them know why they oppose this legislation and that they do oppose this legislation. And most importantly, they're going to have to show up at the Capitol and speak directly with legislators once the session starts on January 9th.
So, campus carry coming to a college near you, probably.
It seemed like part of their argument, each of their arguments, they cited studies that showing that, you know, on the one hand, having concealed weapons makes an area safer because, you know, you're
able
to...
Might be less targeted.
Yeah, it might be, yeah. That was Collins's argument. But on the other hand, Letting was citing studies that were saying that, in fact, it makes an area more dangerous because you have the greater chance of a gun going off.
But it could be more dangerous and less likely to have a mass shooting. Those could both exist at the same time.
It's a difficult area to explore as far as like what research actually shows.
I'm sure that we'll have more of those debates. And there was last year. There were a lot of different professors and students that came armed with an array of studies on this. I guess we'll have to follow up with Charlie Collins, but he's citing a study from Columbine, which is a little old. And we've had a lot more mass shootings since then. That was like one of the first big ones.
Yeah.
Anyway, but let's use this as a segue. So that issue is basically about, in some ways, about local control. Republicans are wanting to use Little Rock, a.k.a. Washington, D.C., to legislate out to the boards of trustees to these different colleges. They also, in the last session, told cities they couldn't make laws regarding anti-discrimination and LGBT ordinances. So it's kind of a shift away from local control in some ways. And there's another bill filed, Chris, that you looked at by Northwest Arkansas State Senator Gary Stubblefield that had to do with the issue of local control.
Yeah, that was bills filed today as we record this on Friday. And it would basically prohibit any municipalities in the state from becoming sanctuary cities, this moniker for cities that protect undocumented immigrants from prosecution on the sole basis that they've violated federal immigration laws. Examples of sanctuary cities include many major cities in the country, like Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and a host of others. Currently, there aren't any sanctuary cities in Arkansas.
There's not a problem that actually needs to be solved with this bill. It's just kind of an ideological statement.
I would venture to guess that, you know, with the, I guess, campaign rhetoric of Donald Trump making tougher immigration policies a hallmark of his campaign, that, you know, maybe Stubblefield is riding on the coattails of that sentiment, but it, you know, that's of course a bit of speculation. I don't know how, I guess, enthusiastic of a supporter.
Well, he might have filed the bill anyway, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
I'm sure he thought that by himself.
Yeah, I know that, like, you know, our congressional delegation has largely opposed this idea of sanctuary cities. I think Tom Cotton has been pretty outspoken against sanctuary cities. Like you said, I mean, it's probably not going to really change anything in Arkansas as far as we can tell, unless, I mean, Donald Trump's, you know, said he wants to deport illegal immigrants in higher numbers than what, you know, we've seen in the Obama administration. So, I mean, it could be that a city and municipality in Arkansas would want to protect some of their residents from an action like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll mention just on the side, I mean, like Little Rock, although it's not a sanctuary city by any means, it's planning a municipal ID program that can be used by undocumented residents who need like banking accounts and things like that. So there are cities in the state that do enact policies that would be considered beneficial, although they're not protecting immigrants from federal law.
Another bill, it's not filed this week, but State Representative Andy Mayberry out of the Hensley area, just east of Little Rock, southeast of Little Rock. He says next week he's going to introduce legislation further curtailing abortion. The Family Council of Arkansas, a conservative Christian organization, they've sent out numerous mailers to their mailing list, which I'm a member of. Recently, they have a whole slew of anti-abortion bills that they are trying to cook up right now. But Andy Mayberry says he'll sponsor this one. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the restriction he has in mind?
Andy Mayberry, who's a state representative from Saline County, did previously sponsor a bill that went into law of a 20-week abortion ban in 2013 that passed after Mike Beebe, the Democratic governor, vetoed it.
Well, in that session, and then that bill was usurped by Jason Raper, its 12-week abortion ban, which was struck down in court later.
Yeah, struck down in federal court. This latest bill would impose a ban on a medical procedure called dilation and evacuation, or D&E, which is a very commonly used procedure, abortion procedure, done in the second trimester.
Although it's a small percentage of the abortions done in Arkansas.
Right. Most are in the first trimester. And so, yeah, like you said, it's kind of along a lineage of, I guess, pro-life or anti-abortion bills that have been filed in the legislature ever since 2013 session. 20 weeks has been, I guess, upheld by federal court as a constitutional ban. The issue here in most abortion laws or restrictive abortion laws is this issue of viability of the fetus outside the womb. I think in the Roe versus Wade decision, the Supreme Court at that time in the 70s wrote that 28 weeks was a point of viability. But in subsequent court cases, that hard line of 28 weeks has kind of been pushed down, I guess, to the point where, you know, 20 weeks is generally accepted, and several states have 20-week abortion bans. 14 weeks, I guess it's kind of in between that 12-week ban, which Jason Raypert had sponsored, which was ruled unconstitutional.
Surely, yeah, right. Yeah.
And, you know, in the 20 weeks. So, I don't know. You know,
well, we could have a new Supreme Court, too.
That's another thing. Donald Trump has pledged to appoint pro-life justices to the Supreme Court or anti-abortion justices.
This is the last thing I'll say about this. So Andy Mayberry was in the legislature in the past, left because of term limits, I think, and then they changed term limits, so he's back. And his wife was in his seat before, so the Mayberry family is dominating the seat. And she passed some of the leading pro-life legislation of the last session. All right, so that's kind of some of the legislation trickling in. There's a lot of bills coming out. It's going to be hard to keep track of, but good thing we started early.
Yeah, usually there's about, a couple thousand bills filed per legislative session or something.
Yeah, I guess. But so far, it's just like four or five a day. So bad. Okay, so that kind of wraps up all the serious business. But this weekend could be a weekend of leisure. This is the North Little Rock Charging Wildcats Band. Chris Hickey, you've got the sports paper there from the Democrat Gazette. Our own David Wallace, the Saturday morning anchor, does some live sports announcing this weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be at Moore Memorial Stadium. The Arkansas State High School Championship football games are kicking off tonight on Friday at 7 p.m. at War Memorial. We've got the undefeated North Little Rock team in a 7A game against Fayetteville High School, which has a record of 11-1.
North Little Rock is undefeated, right?
Yeah, undefeated. And a female kicker on the team.
Whoa!
I think she's a senior, yeah, which is kind of unusual.
Okay, so it's a high school football championship stuff at War Memorial. So there'll be like a few thousand people there for a few different games. And the future of War Memorial, there it is.
Yeah.
they're already doing the future.
And tomorrow in the 6A game, we got Russellville versus Greenwood. Russellville is an 11-1 team, and Greenwood is 12-0. And that's in the evening. In the morning, we got Wynn versus Pulaski Academy in the 5A game.
Oh, okay.
And then it continues next week.
Pulaski Academy, it's worth noting, in recent years has been in all sorts of national publications because I don't know if it's their current coach, but probably he never punted. They would always go on fourth down versus some, I don't know. Anyway, football
innovation.
Yeah, sure. The other recreational activity, perhaps you don't want to watch the action on the gridiron. Instead, you might want to take a more gentle path, the path of Noel. And watch the Capitol Dome light up with Christmas lights, all 71,000 of them, I'm told. But the big problem is it's going to rain all weekend, so football games will be bad to watch, or kind of epic because of all the, well, they don't even have mud, they have turf on that field now.
The football will be slippery.
Yeah, there you go, the pigskin. Made of C&H Hog Farm pigskin. Okay, so... the Capitol lighting ceremony, it's going to rain, so they're moving it inside. So you don't get, they're going to flip a big switch and you get to see the dome turn on, but now you can't unless you want to stay outside in the rain, which maybe is worth it. But Mark Martin will be inside flipping the switch, and they have a Christmas tree inside that has 8,000 lights, so maybe they'll plug that in. There you go. And
can't wait to see it.
Bah humbug, I asked Chris Powell, the Secretary of State spokesman, about the separation of church and state. you know, being as that Christmas is the celebration of Jesus' birthday in Christianity, clearly religion. He said that separation of church and state is maintained, and there aren't any overt religious symbols. Of course, there's a gospel choir there. Yeah. Gospel is definitely got a perspective on religion. Okay, well, that's been the week in review. Thanks a lot, Chris Hickey. I'm Jacob Kaufman. You've been listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. We're a listener-supported station funded by the University of Arkansas Little Rock and UAMS. We are editorially dependent. Independent of both. All right, thanks for listening this week. Have a good weekend.
Bye.